Zechariah chapter 14 is prophecy in the grand manner. Now, I want to say one or two general things about this chapter and its special relation with New Testament prophecy, with which it has so much in common. You may recall that at the start of our studies in the book of Zechariah, I pointed out that the prophecy of Zechariah is divided into two unequal parts. Chapters 1 to 8 stand on their own, and chapters 9 to the end also stand on their own. And each of these two sections of the book is concerned with history, the history of the people of God in particular, but also with other histories, history of men and of wars and conflicts and earthquakes and so on. But the difference between the two parts of the book is this, that in the first 8 chapters, history is seen from the divine perspective, from the heavenly point of view. It's history seen through the eyes of God, looking down on the affairs of men. And so in those first 8 chapters, history is presented to us in that wonderful series of 8 visions. From chapter 9 onwards to the end of the book, we are still seeing history. But this time, it's history down to earth. History as a newspaper reporter might see it, or a television camera, or a radio announcer. History as it is down here, here and now, with wars and tumults and confusion and so on. That's the difference between the two parts of the book of Zechariah. But in the 14th chapter, the last chapter of the book, we rush out of history and out of time. And in chapter 14, we come to the end of time as we know it, and to the end of history as we know it, and to the start of eternity. Because chapter 14 of Zechariah is about the second coming of Christ and the end of the world. I like to make a distinction between short-term prophecy and long-term prophecy. And you find both of these in the Bible. For example, there's a great deal of short-term prophecy in the book of Zechariah. Chapters 9 to 13 in the second half have said a great deal about the coming of Christ into the world. And in these chapters, 9 to 13, you almost have a unifying message. Christ is coming. Now, of course, there are lots of other things in those chapters, but the central message is Christ is coming. And he's portrayed as coming in all sorts of ways. For example, in chapter 9 and verse 9, you can almost hear the solo from Handel's Messiah. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee, meek and lowly, riding on an ass. Now, that is short-term prophecy, because that was fulfilled on Palm Sunday, when Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee, meek and lowly. Short-term prophecy fulfilled in the coming of Christ. In chapter 10, you see, Christ is mentioned in every chapter. In chapter 10, at verses 3 and 4, there is a picture of Christ, the cornerstone. And the idea is of a mason's yard, or a builder's yard. And the building is going up. And the building is completed, but there is one gap left in the wall. And they can't find a stone to fill this gap. And here in the yard, lying amongst all the rubbish and the rubble, there is this clumsy, awkward stone that the builders had thought was of no importance. And that's the stone that completes the wall. Christ, the rejected cornerstone. And if you know the scriptures of the New Testament, you'll know that that is one of the glorious themes of preaching in the book of Acts. The early apostles were always telling the Jews that this man whom they had crucified, this despised stone, was now the chief cornerstone in the eyes of God. The stone that the builders set at naught has become the head of the corner. Christ, the cornerstone. Well, that is a short-term prophecy. It's mentioned in Zechariah, and it was fulfilled in the coming of Christ. Christ is mentioned in chapter 11 also of Zechariah, where this time he is portrayed as the rejected shepherd, particularly in 11 verses 8 and 12 onwards, where the rejected shepherd is sold for 30 pieces of silver. And in fact, Matthew quotes that passage in Zechariah as being fulfilled in the story of Judas, the rejected shepherd. Christ is coming. This is what he will be like. In chapter 12 and verse 10, he is portrayed as the one who has been pierced. They shall look upon him whom they have pierced and shall mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, the pierced one. In chapter 13, same story, Christ is coming, only this time it's the smitten shepherd. Chapter 13, verse 7, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the pasture shall be scattered abroad. Now you see, all of these mentions of the coming Christ push forward in time till the day that Jesus was born, because he is the king on the donkey, and he is the rejected cornerstone. He is the rejected shepherd. He is the pierced one and the smitten shepherd. And all these are examples of short-term prophecies that find their fulfillment in Jesus Christ. But when you come to chapter 14, you are now into a different world. You are into the world of long-term prophecy. Prophecy that is pushed right to the end of time and to the end of history. Because the promise in chapter 14 is not simply that Christ will come again, but that when he comes again, he comes for the last time, the second and the last coming of Christ. And the promise of chapter 14 is not simply that God will come, but that when God comes, he will reign over all the earth. Verse 9 in particular, the Lord will become king over all the earth on that day. The Lord will be one, and his name will be one. And so on. That's the first point. This is long-term prophecy, pushing us right to the end of time and into eternity. Second point is this. How are we going to understand this difficult chapter? Do we take it literally? Is this about the geographical city of Jerusalem? Is this about Christ's feet actually touching the Mount of Olives and splitting the Mount of Olives? Is this actually about springs in Jerusalem flowing into the Mediterranean and flowing down into the Dead Sea? Do you take this literally, just as it stands? Or do you interpret it spiritually? That's to say, is this a parable of something else? Is it a picture or an allegory teaching us What will happen at the end of time? I'm bound to say here that I drank in the literal understanding of this with my mother's milk. And the literal understanding is certainly the more tempting of the two. Verse 2, for example, speaks about all the nations being gathered against Jerusalem. And that does seem to tie up with the fact that in the New Testament, it is suggested that at the end of the age, the nations of the earth will be gathered up under Antichrist against Jerusalem. Verse 3 speaks about the Lord stepping in at the last moment when everything seemed lost and his cause seems finished. The Lord steps in at the last moment with his saints. And that also seems to tie up with the battle of Armageddon, as you find it described in the book of Revelation. In verse 4, we read about the Lord coming down on the Mount of Olives. And that seems to push us forward to the first chapter of Acts, where we read about the ascension of Christ. He went to his Father from the Mount of Olives, and the angel messenger says to the disciples, "Ye men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus shall so come again in like manner as you have seen him go." Verses 4 and 5 speak about earthquakes and convulsions in nature. Cold and frost disappear. How unnatural. Day and night disappear. How unnatural. And all of that does seem to point forward to Christ's promise that before the end of the age, there will be disturbances in the heavens. Stars falling from their courses, the moon turned into blood, wars and rumors of war, and so on. Now, all of that, to my mind, is immensely attractive. However, it does raise more problems than it solves. An earthquake, such as is described in verse 4 onwards, would not only split the Mount of Olives in two, it would destroy Jerusalem. If the Mount of Olives is to be split in two, opening up a valley to the east, and if the Kidron Valley is to be blocked up and be a valley no more, there would be such upheavals in nature that the whole area would be devastated. There would be no Jerusalem left. You could not have all that volcanic and earthquake activity going on that side of the city and the city remaining intact. It would be impossible. And there's another problem. The New Testament says that every eye shall see him. But if Christ is coming back locally to the Mount of Olives, how can every eye see him? If you're living in China, how could you see him? Or if you're living in Australia or in America, how could you see him if he's coming back locally to the Mount of Olives? Now, it may well be that you do accept this chapter literally just as it stands. And if you do, then I respect and I honor your position, but I do not agree with you. I believe that what we have here is apocalyptic imagery. That's to say, imagery that tells us the truth, or pictures that tell us the truth. And these pictures in Revelation 14 are to be understood and interpreted spiritually. They are spiritual truth for God's children for the last times. And I believe that out of all this imagery, there spring two eternal messages for Christians. The first is Jerusalem surrounded, and the second is Jerusalem safe. First of all, Jerusalem surrounded. Towards the end of the age, the Jerusalem of Christ, the Church of Jesus Christ, is to be surrounded and besieged and beleaguered by all nations. Now I want you to drink this in, because many Christians and many churchmen do not accept this view of human history. It is the plain teaching of Jesus Christ that the entire world of evil, just before the end, will gang up against God and against His Christ and against His Church. Christians will be a beleaguered remnant. That's on the books, according to Jesus, according to Zechariah, according to John, and according to the Apostle Paul. That's on the books. This is what will happen. And that means, of course, that the immediate outlook for Christians is pessimistic. Have you got the Christian courage to be an optimist inside pessimism? The Russian Christians are learning it. The Czechs are learning it. The Hungarian Christians are learning this. How to be optimists in a pessimistic situation. And that's unacceptable to many cheery Christians. You see, I think the trouble is that from last century, and particularly from the Victorians, we have inherited a rather optimistic view of world history. The idea of the Christianization of the world. Or the missionaries go out, and the word goes out, and society becomes permeated with the gospel and with Christian principles. Christ going forth conquering and to conquer. That sort of view. If you read any book of Victorian sermons, especially sermons by the great pulpit giants of Victoria's age, there was this incredible optimism about the future of the world and the future of human history. The earth shall be filled with the knowledge of God as the waters cover the sea. And good old G.K. Chesterton hammered the nail on the head in his book called Orthodoxy. There's a chapter called The Flag of the Universe. You know what the flag of the universe is, according to Chesterton? Optimism. The Christianizing of the world. There are very, very, very few verses in the Bible that suggest that that will happen. On the contrary, there are some very, very dark passages, and I want to read a few of these with you now. First of all, in Luke chapter 21. If you have the scriptures, will you turn them up? Perhaps you just care to listen. Luke chapter 21 and verse 5. Bit from Luke and then maybe one or two bits from Revelation. Luke 21 and 5. And as some spoke of the temple in Jerusalem, how it was adorned with noble stones and offerings, Jesus said, "As for these things which you see, the days will come when there shall not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." He asked him, "Teacher, when will this be? What will be the sign when this is about to take place?" And he said, "Take heed that you are not led astray," doesn't answer the question. For many will come in my name, saying, I am he, the Christ, and the time is at hand. Do not go after them. And when you hear of wars and tumults, do not be terrified, for this must first take place, but the end will not be at once. Then he said to them, nation will rise against nation. Fancy Muslims gobbling each other up tonight. Who would believe it? Fanatical Muslims killing each other. Extraordinary. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, and in various places, famines. How contemporary this all is. Those poor skeletons of children on television. In a world of plenty, famines and pestilences, and there will be terrors, whatever that means, and great signs from heaven, stars shaking. But before all this, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. In one breath, churches and jails, one breath. You will be brought before kings and governors for my name's sake. This will be a time for you to bear testimony. Think of the Christians. Think of Regelson last week in front of the Russian court with the carefully selected judge, the carefully selected newspaper reporters, the carefully selected jury, and no outsiders admitted. The courage of these Russian Christians. Not much wonder Solzhenitsyn says that the West needs to learn this lesson, that Christians need courage above everything else in this generation. 13. This will be a time for you to bear testimony. Settle it therefore in your minds, not to meditate beforehand how to answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which none of your adversaries will be able to withstand or contradict. You will be delivered up even by parents and brothers. Terrible. And kinsmen and friends. And some of you, they will put to death. You will be hated by all men for my name's sake. But not a hair of your head will perish. By your endurance, you will gain your lives or your souls. Wonder if any of these Victorian optimistic preachers read that. Wonder what they made of that. And I wonder what they made of Revelation chapter 13. John's vision of the beasts. It's interesting that just before chapter 13, he's standing on the seashore and looking into the sea of mankind. And it's from mankind that the beasts come. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea of mankind, with 10 horns, 7 heads, 10 diadems upon its horns, and a blasphemous name upon its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon, Satan, gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of the beast's heads seemed to have a mortal wound. Christ slew the beast in his death. Christ dealt the beast a mortal blow. But its mortal wound was healed. The resurrection of evil. The whole earth followed the beast with wonder. Men worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? And who can fight against it?" All nations against Jerusalem. The beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming God's name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven, the angels, the saints, cursing them. And also it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and tongue and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. That's the picture. A world ruled by evil, a regime of terror and tyranny. And the work of Christ and the people of Christ almost obliterated. And at that split second in time, Jesus will come. Oh, I love the daring of God. I speak humanly. I love God's courage. He loves to wait until his enemies think they're all sure and safe and secure in their wickedness. And then he pounces. All those who imagine themselves to be secure against God, unaware that eternity was about to fall on their heads. Do you know the story of Beria, who was the chief of Stalin's secret police? He was responsible in his time for the torture and the death of millions. A vile, filthy, cruel, sadistic fellow. Alas for Beria, how was he to know that his master Stalin was a paranoid and trusted no one? That's why so many of Stalin's friends and colleagues died. In the end, he distrusted them all and killed them. Beria thought he was secure, but his turn came, and the man who had knocked on so many doors in the middle of the night found someone knocking at his door. I believe that in the end, Stalin ordered tanks to blow the house to pieces and bury her in it. Suddenly,
He was no more. Oh, the daring of God. He allows his work almost to die. Then he comes. It was so with Khrushchev. You remember he said that if there was a God in the skies, his astronauts would soon sweep him from the throne. Well, God is still on the throne. And where is Mr. Khrushchev? At the last moment, Christ will come. And that, of course, brings us to Jerusalem safe. And the new Jerusalem is pictured to us here in a series of wonderful portraits. In verse 4, the split in the Mount of Olives means that because of the valley, you now have a clear view of the sunrise. You see, that Mount of Olives blocks the east from Jerusalem as a shadow when the sun rises. But because of the valley, you can see right through to the sun rising. In verse 6, which must surely be the millennium for a Scotsman, extremes of temperature disappear, neither cold nor frost. There's a temperate climate, and night, as we know it, disappears. In verse 8, something most precious to any city built on a rock, there is a natural water supply. Waters from the rock of Zion. And on that day, living waters shall flow from Jerusalem. In verse 11, there is everlasting security for the new Jerusalem. In verse 14, the world's wealth is poured into the city to beautify and to glorify God's new Jerusalem. And in verse 20, everything inside the city is holy. Pots and cups and saucers and forks and knives. Nothing is common. Even the very bells on the bridles of the horses are all holy for the Lord. And in the last sentence, there are no more traders in the house of God. There's no more need to make money for Christ's work. After all, do you need money in a city whose pavements are made of gold and whose gates are made of pearl? Jerusalem will be safe. The Jerusalem of Jesus. And my friend, the only way to be sure that you will be safe then is to make sure that you are in Christ now. You are in Christ, aren't you? Or are you in the church, but not in Christ? Are you in the church and outside the kingdom? Like the man in the Gospels who was not far from the kingdom. If you're in Christ now, when this marvelous, self-contained New Jerusalem comes, you will be safe forever. May God grant let it be so. May he add a blessing to the preaching of his word. Now we sing this hymn as we come to ordination. to Vaughan Williams' lovely tune, hymn 191, Come Down, O Love Divine, Seek Thou This Soul of Mine, hymn 191.